Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Debt ceiling deadlock leads President Biden to cut short a key trip to Asia. Plus new abortion restrictions in North Carolina. And America's rivals scramble to attract foreign workers.
Coming out of the pandemic, lots of wealthy countries have extremely low unemployment and very large amounts of job vacancies. And also the labor force is suddenly starting to shrink as baby boomers retire in larger numbers.
It's Wednesday, May 17th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. And here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. We begin again in Washington, a day after President Biden and top lawmakers failed to reach a deal to raise the U.S. debt ceiling and avoid the country's first ever default. And with the so-called X date nearing, the day when the Treasury Department will run out of room to sell new debt, the debt ceiling impasse is now hamstringing other U.S. priorities, leading Biden to cut short a planned trip to Asia. Journal White House reporter Annie Linsky is in Tokyo ahead of that trip. All right, Annie, what's the state of play this morning?
Yeah, there's been a lot of rejiggering going on with the president's schedule. I'm in Tokyo right now and heading to Hiroshima for the G7, which was supposed to be the first stop on Biden's trip through Asia and has become now the only stop on his trip through Asia. So there's a lot of smoothing over that the administration is doing right now with various allies who'd expected meetings and visits by the United States president. It does change the way Biden's trip is seen in the world and the way his message is received in the world. It's also really underscoring just how significant these debt talks are in the U.S. And I think a lot of allies had believed that this is something that was going to be solved fairly easily. And it's now spotlighted that this is not an issue that's going to be solved very easily or quickly.
And just detail for us, which elements of the trip have been canceled as of now and what effect that could have on U.S. relations and U.S. priorities abroad?
There are two main thrusts of this trip. One is sort of bringing allies together and showing kind of a united resolve in the war in Ukraine against Russia. And that is getting a little muddied now because there just isn't the same amount of sort of time and focus on it. And then the second major issue is an attempt that President Biden is trying to bring allies together in a common approach to China. And that also becomes more difficult. He was supposed to go to Australia to meet with leaders of Australia, Japan, and India, the Quad. That's now canceled. And so it does disrupt that sort of proactive message that the Biden administration was trying to push in the world. And so it is a very disruptive change in the way that the United States is trying to conduct foreign policy and trying to kind of reorient foreign policy to counter this sort of growing economic power that China is using and the way that China is using its power.
Okay, so with Biden due back in Washington in just a few days, what can we actually expect in terms of his next move? I know we're reporting this morning that Democrats on Capitol Hill are launching a discharge petition to kind of force a vote on the debt ceiling. What does the White House make of those efforts?
Well, the discharge petition is an interesting one. What that would entail is a bill would come to the floor that goes around the typical process, which is that the Speaker of the House, who's a Republican, Kevin McCarthy, can bring, he typically and almost always controls the House floor. If 218 members of Congress sign on to a piece of legislation, there is a way to circumvent the Speaker's power. It is an extraordinary thing to do. It has happened only a few times in U.S. history. When it has happened, it's happened with sort of the implicit support of the Speaker, even though it's essentially going around the Speaker. So I think it's a very difficult maneuver, but I think what it shows is the concern that is growing in Washington that there will not be a deal by this X date. So this is getting at how delicate these negotiations are and how far apart the two sides are at this point.
That was Wall Street Journal reporter Annie Linsky in Tokyo. Annie, thanks for filling us in on the details.
Thank you. It's been great to do it.
And we've got several updates today related to abortion access in the United States, beginning in North Carolina, where lawmakers have pushed through a law banning most abortions after 12 weeks of pregnancy. The state's Republican-led legislature yesterday overrode Democratic Governor Roy Cooper's earlier veto of that bill, setting up the law to take effect in the coming months. Democratic Representative Julie Von Hafen and Republican Representative Kristen Baker were on opposite sides of the issue, as heard in footage captured by Reuters.
You've already heard from many others tonight about how this bill will hurt women in our state, how it will hurt business, how it will hurt families, how it will hurt women coming here from other states to seek health care. So why? Why are you doing this? Why are you so determined to subvert the popular will of our state?
It is a duty to protect each and every life. Each and every life. That is exactly what Senate Bill 20 does. And that is exactly why the only two physicians in the entire North Carolina General Assembly are supporting Senate Bill 20.
The move in North Carolina signals the GOP's willingness to adopt tough abortion restrictions in swing states where it has political power, though at least for now, that may not include Pennsylvania. Voters in the Philadelphia suburbs helped Democrats to maintain a narrow majority in the state's House in a special election Tuesday. That Democratic victory could affect a proposed constitutional amendment to limit abortion rights that state Republicans are just one House floor vote away from putting to voters as a referendum. And the legal battle over nationwide access to a widely used abortion pill will return to the courtroom today. A federal appeals court in New Orleans is set to probe the FDA's approval of the drug mifepristone, which currently remains on the market while litigation proceeds. A ruling could take weeks or months, with the losing side likely to petition the U.S. Supreme Court to review the case. Coming up, while the U.S. remains at odds over allowing more foreign workers into the country, global rivals are lowering immigration barriers in a bid to address persistent labor shortages. We'll look at what a number of wealthy countries are doing to open their borders wider after the break.
Technology can make the world better. At UST, we're building a future where people everywhere are empowered to live better lives.
It's transformation you can feel.
And you don't have to do it alone.
We believe in the power of technology to transform businesses and build a better world.
Washington remains divided over immigration policy as thousands of migrants continue to put pressure on the southern border. But other countries are actually scrambling to attract foreign workers in order to ease persistent labor shortages. And Journal reporter Tom Fairless has been looking at this trend. Tom, you report migration into affluent countries is currently at a record high. What is driving this?
So among affluent countries, a number of governments have changed their immigration laws in a way that loosens them. And I suppose the immediate background is the pandemic, which shook up labor markets and economies everywhere. And suddenly coming out of the pandemic, lots of wealthy countries have extremely low unemployment and very large amounts of job vacancies. And also the wealthy economies are at a tipping point demographically where the labor force is suddenly starting to shrink quite quickly as baby boomers retire in larger numbers. And so to address this crunch, a number of countries, even countries that have had quite high unemployment rates for a long time, like Spain, which has an unemployment rate of 13%. Their immigration minister told me that they need a net 300,000 immigrants per year over the coming decades to keep their labour market in balance. So, for instance, Germany has kind of lowered the bar for certain types of migrants, where rather than having formal requirements for degrees or professional qualifications, they're allowing more unskilled or lower skilled workers to arrive. For instance, I spoke to butchers in southern Germany, especially in the wealthy regions close to Switzerland. And they just have a terrible time trying to find people to take on the kind of manual work that they do. All the young people in the West are increasingly well-educated. I spoke to one butcher whose son is a professor of mathematical statistics and didn't want to go down his father's career path. And so these people are bringing in young Indians to work as butchers in southern Germany. Another interesting example is Australia. And Western Australia is a region that has all these mines that are rich in the minerals that are needed for the battery-powered cars. And they have too much work. And some of their government officials came recently to Britain to try and attract tens of thousands of Brits to go and work in Australia. He told me, actually, that he said his catchphrase was, "Our ancestors came to Australia as criminals, but now it would be a crime for you not to come to move here." So I thought it was quite good.
And Tom, are these policies already having an economic effect?
Well, in the US, there was a report by a pro-immigration think tank. The US has actually received hundreds of thousands of refugees over the last couple of years from Ukraine and from Afghanistan. And this report found that these refugees who were able to work in the US under the government's protection have reduced the number of outstanding job vacancies by about one quarter. But I mean, there's different views among economists, and some economists are skeptical about using migration to fill labor shortages, because they think that you're basically kicking the can down the road. And while it increases the workforce in the short term, in the longer term, you're going to end up with more old people anyway, as the migrants age. So some economists think it isn't a permanent solution.
And we should note that that is not the only critique, economic or otherwise, of these immigration policies.
Yeah, that's right. Immigration is not very popular among voters. And in a lot of countries, a majority or a plurality of voters do not agree that there should be more migration. And you see that in the US, and you see that in countries like Australia as well. I suppose, you know, a lot of voters are worried about their jobs and about the strain on public services. But I think especially they're worried about what they might perceive as uncontrolled migration, which you see across the southern border in the US. And voters get quite anxious about that.
Tom, there are restrictive immigration policies in the US at present. And yet, as you document, there are also some political efforts underway to try and attract more foreign workers, not least in states like Utah and Indiana, where the labor market remains really tight.
The US, to be clear, is still one of the biggest, or even the biggest, recipient of immigrants. And what's different about the US is that it hasn't reformed its immigration laws since 1990. And so it hasn't created new legal pathways like some of these other countries, including countries like Japan, which have been historically very skeptical of immigration. And so what we have over the last few years is these refugees who are coming under temporary kind of protection from the Biden administration. And so one small change is that these two Republican governors in Utah and Indiana are proposing that the states should have more control over who arrives and should be able to issue a certain number of work visas that are controlled by Congress. They proposed that recently in an op-ed. But otherwise, there still doesn't seem to be much will in the U.S. to reform the legal immigration pathways.
And that was Wall Street Journal reporter Tom Fairless in London. Tom, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Luke.
In other news today, we are exclusively reporting that disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein transferred funds for political activist and professor Noam Chomsky and paid $150,000 to the longtime leader of Bard College, Leon Botstein, the two academics have confirmed. We have previously reported that both men met multiple times with Epstein after he was a registered sex offender. Chomsky said that he met occasionally with Epstein to discuss political and academic topics, and that the transfer from an Epstein-linked account was, quote, restricted to rearrangement of my own funds and did not involve one penny from Epstein. Botstein, meanwhile, said he received checks from an account linked to Epstein in 2016, totaling about $150,000, and that he donated the sum to Bard that year as part of a larger donation. Elon Musk has teased two new Tesla models at the company's annual shareholder meeting, while forecasting near-term economic challenges for the carmaker as higher interest rates pinch buyers. Musk didn't provide details about the new products, though he did say that Tesla could produce more than 5 million units a year of the two models combined. This was the first shareholder meeting since Musk said that Linda Yaccarino would be taking over from him as CEO of Twitter. And WSJ reporter Anna Hertenstein explains why Musk was seeking to reassure some Tesla investors.
There were some investors who said they were concerned that Musk hadn't focused enough on Tesla during the takeover of Twitter. And he said that Twitter was a short-term distraction. And he said that he now thinks the company's in a stable place. He also said he hasn't considered stepping down as Tesla's CEO. And it is important to remember, though, that Tesla has lost nearly half of its market value since its last annual meeting in August last year. So he does have his work cut out for him.
And Swiss bank UBS is preparing for a $4 billion legal and regulatory hit from its acquisition of Credit Suisse and expecting other asset write-downs, too. An updated version of the merger prospectus also shows that UBS expects to book a $34.8 billion gain on negative goodwill when a company acquires assets for less than they're worth, typically in a distressed situation. And finally, what to do when fans aren't showing up to your games? Well, the German soccer team Fortuna Düsseldorf has come up with a radical fix for declining attendance: giving away tickets for free. The pilot project is partly a move to bolster support among fans, though WSJ sports reporter Rachel Bachmann says the club does see a financial logic behind the plan, too.
For many clubs, ticket revenue is a very important source of revenue, and the ticket prices are very high. And what Fortuna Düsseldorf concluded was that they might do better just simply replacing the revenue they had hoped to get from attendance with corporate sponsorships. So this really is a creative response to rising demand for people's time, and also, I think, a measure of goodwill from the club to reward them for their loyalty, the fans, and also to reassure them that they are trying to support the club financially for the future.
And that's What's News for Wednesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.